little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Bob.
Well, I'm very excited about this episode. Well, like I always say in the introduction, this is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And in our previous 99 episodes, our topics have ranged very broadly from an introduction to artificial intelligence, where we did a demonstration of using the large language model ChatGPT, which is so much in the news now, to descriptions and demonstrations of how to have a civil dialogue. But in this, our 100th episode, we're going to return to the fundamentals of critical thinking and have as a return guest a man who has produced the most succinct and comprehensive multimedia critical thinking tutorials that I know of. And early on, I drew heavily from those tutorials for inspiration, information, and skill building.
So today's topics include why critical thinking is important and how we can get more people to do it, a description of fundamental skills involved in critical thinking and where to start learning them, how to add to your skills if you're already a critical thinker, biases in human reasoning, and other topics.
And our guest, Kevin DeLaplante, has a unique history beginning in his childhood with a fascination of both the arts and the sciences. In fact, at one point, he had serious thoughts about becoming a professional cartoonist. And as he developed and started thinking about the big questions that I love and am still thinking about, for example, what is space? What is time? How does the brain work? What is consciousness? And that sparked, of course, an interest in philosophy. And then as he got older, that mixture of interests brought him to Carleton University in Canada, where his focus on science earned him a bachelor's degree in physics. But then, when considerations of graduate studies approached, his educational goals had shifted, and he completed a master's degree and a doctorate degree in philosophy at Western University in Canada. Now, we're going to ask him to fill in some of the details about his interesting career journey after his decision to leave a tenured professorship position at Iowa State University, and to bring us up to date on his current job and his ongoing involvement with critical thinking. But first, I want to say, Kevin DeLaplante, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you for having me on. It's wonderful to be back. I appreciate your show so much. It's a unique show. I was looking at your guest list for the past history, and there's just nothing like it. No show, no podcast, no radio show has this list of people focused in this area. So I'm so happy that you guys are still doing this.
Oh, we appreciate that, Kevin, and thanks for coming back. So this is your third time returning to Thinking Clearly. You were a second-time guest back in 2018. A lot's happened since then. Listeners can go back to our archive, as I mentioned earlier, thinkingclearly.libsyn.com, and can go back and visit episodes 15 and 24 from 2017 and 2018, respectively. And here's some interesting details about your choice to leave academia and pursue a new career as an independent educator and consultant. 2018, that seems like a million years away. Can you take us on a brief tour and catch us up with what's been going on with your life and your work experience and what you've been up to since then?
Okay, yeah, well, for sure. Yeah, it really has been like three eras, right? So 1999 to 2015, that was the academia era at Iowa State, and was largely just, you know, spending most of my time doing research and teaching there. But I had started producing this content, these video content to supplement my critical thinking courses, my philosophy of science courses. And then I started putting them up on the web because under the pressure to do like flipped classroom teaching, where you put more of your lectures online, so you can spend more time in the classroom doing discussion and so forth. And that was sort of also at the birth of, internet-based businesses with subscription websites and things like that. And then I realized that there was an opportunity here to reach a broader audience than just the classroom audience with this technology and this content. So I ended up thinking about growing out an online business, which I built over a period of years while I was still an academic. And then I pulled the plug in 2013, 2014. I told our department chair that I was leaving. And in 2014, we left. And I spent a couple of years doing basically online critical thinking business development. But I got connected with folks at Linker, which is a growth consulting and marketing services firm in the Minneapolis area. And John Linker reached out to me because he was a fan of the original Critical Thinker podcast back from 2012. And he wanted to connect, and he was a fan. And we ended up having building out a relationship where I started helping him out with certain kinds of research and analysis and writing gigs. And that grew into a partnership that eventually, so my stream basically merged with the development of this business consultancy, management consultancy firm. And now I've actually become a partner in that firm. So there are three partners in the firm. It's been around for a while. It's still a small firm, but we're growing. And along the way, people have asked me sometimes, what attracted you to business management, consulting, marketing, like I'm sure branding? Isn't this the farthest thing from your interests in physics and philosophy, right? And critical thinking. Well, here's the thing though, that what I had found in my brief time as an independent consultant was I was reaching out to organizations and individuals and seeing if they could use my services as a critical thinking expert, a consultant. And so you're effectively addressing people's organizational needs. So you're working with larger teams. They have objectives and goals. All these organizations work within some kind of institutional context or a market context where that matters to what they're doing. And they all have needs, a real need for insight into these areas because their work involves persuasion, argumentation, communication at various levels, and either persuading their own team to do things or persuading their audiences to do and believe things. And so the expertise ended up being valuable, but it was very practical too. Like you could tell if you were doing a bad job. Like one of the differences between teaching in a classroom is that it's a captive audience in a public university where the classes fill up regardless of what you do. I can teach however I want there. And the next semester, a whole new batch of people shows up and sits and fills the seats and has to listen to you. So it turned out that the way that you fill the seats was there was a marketplace for these things, and students could choose whether to attend your class or not. And they'd pay you for it directly. And so you'd have to earn their interest over time, because if you weren't engaging them, they didn't feel like they were getting value, they would just leave. That's that market focus means that you get feedback about whether things are working or not. And I was very interested in figuring out and learning about the process of learning how to help someone. So you often get these requests from people about, I have a critical thinking or a persuasion need. I want to convince people in my municipality to support this policy versus that policy, or I've got to train my people to do this or that. And when you're outside of the cloistered halls of academia, you have to learn how to actually create results for people that people value. And so I thought this is an opportunity to kind of learn about how the street works, as the dojo versus street distinction that I talked about probably last time. There's this martial arts analogy between learning how skills of combat in the dojo, where you've got this sort of controlled environment, the instructor, you work through these, patterned forms, and you have these rituals and rules, and you increase your skill level, but you're not actually hitting anyone with real intent to hurt them. Whereas on the street, those same skills may or may not be useful because street rules are different. And in some sense, the marketplace of ideas and business context is a kind of street. And so if you, you got to learn how the rules operate there and then adapt to meet the, those rules. And so I think I needed that. I needed that at time, that exposure away from 10, 15 years of academic training in logic and critical thinking and argumentation, which is very much dojo focused, to the street. And not the street just in theory, but it's like my version of actually having to put on gloves, you know, the experience to be highly, very engaging. Because it does recruit a lot of, it fills in gaps in my knowledge, and there's stuff at stake here that matters to myself and other people. That's not quite the same when you're in an academic context.
As a former philosophy major, I hope that all the other philosophy majors are listening, because I don't know how many times I was told that you can't get a job with a philosophy degree.
I'll tell you what, business loves people with philosophy soft skills. Writing skills, communication skills, high-level writing. I walked in, no business experience, right? The fact that I could write long-form documents with logical clarity and communicate that to different audiences clearly put you this much above the average person right away, practically.
From your many years' perspective of thinking about critical thinking, what are the primary benefits? Because critical thinking, to learn those skills, takes some hard work. To implement those skills and make them in a practice in your everyday life, it takes time, it takes effort, it takes concentration. So what are the primary benefits from your perspective for a person choosing to take that time and effort to learn and practice critical thinking? And secondly, what can we do? This is always a frustrating question for me. What can we do to actively recruit more people to that practice?
Well, two parts to that, right?
Yeah.
So the first part is you asked about benefits. And my take on that is that those are going to be related to values that you may or may not hold. If you don't care about certain values, like believing true things as opposed to false things, that didn't matter to you, then you wouldn't have a benefit associated with learning a practice where you are more inclined to believe true things than false things. If you didn't care about your decisions being rational or wise, as opposed to irrational, whatever, if you didn't care about that, then of course the practice, the skills you would have wouldn't matter. So I think fundamentally it comes down to critical thinking is organized around a set of values, rather than a set of skills per se. The values are like the classical model that I would often use to teach with. And I think it's at the root of the Greek tradition of philosophical reasoning, and it's at the root of Western scientific rationality, basically, Enlightenment views of reasoning, is that it's better to believe true beliefs, have true beliefs than false ones. You want more of your beliefs to be true than false. That's one. Number two is you want your reasons, your judgment, your decisions to be wise rather than foolish, rational versus irrational, and so forth. So that's about decision making, really, the basis of your choices. And the third one is about being what they'd say, you know, thinking for yourself in your autonomy as an individual thinker. That gets framed in terms of I want to be responsible for my own beliefs and values. I want to be able to claim ownership of my own beliefs and values. I want to be able to claim to give an account of why I have the beliefs that I do. So all of that is clustered and broken, you know, is under that label of thinking for yourself. And I think of that as a kind of Socratic ideal, that is the ability to give an account of why you hold the views you do and be able to defend them in the face of criticism or objection. That's all like the test of your self-ownership of those views. Now that stuff, when you tack that onto kind of Enlightenment use of reason and rationality or knowledge, you know, that view also talked about knowledge as a kind of correspondence between your understanding, your beliefs about the world, and the objective facts. So there's this notion of objectivity that's built into this picture. defined as that kind of independence of our subjective experience of the world. So, you know, when Neil deGrasse Tyson and Richard Dawkins say, you know, facts don't care about your feelings, it's a slogan that they'll often bring up in debates and so on, that the cold, hard, that the facts, as revealed by a certain kind of scientific methodology, are independent of whether you like those facts or not. And that's part of the scientific worldview, the kind of attitude, is I think that attitude is there. The idea is that there is a reality beyond your immediate understanding, and you want to be willing to subject your assumptions about the world to empirical testing of some kind to put them at risk. And the willingness to do that, the idea that that's a good thing, that's basic to the scientific attitude towards knowledge and understanding, is that sense of putting your assumptions and your beliefs at risk. Now, all that together, I bundled together as sort of critical thinking values. If you endorse those, quite frankly, you're in for a world of pain, right? If you really care about that, the actual world is a frustrating place to operate in, because there's so many forces that are at work to persuade you to believe what they want to believe, or to so you're at the subject of what I called it, you know, a persuasion matrix or a persuasion environment where all these powers that be are trying to influence us. And it would be maybe not so frustrating if we had reason to believe we were really good at this, but it turns out we have reason to believe we're quite bad at this, right? This is the insight of our modern understanding of how human beings actually reason, is that we're good at a lot of things, but we're not necessarily wired for these outcomes: truth over falsity, wisdom over foolishness or whatnot, thinking for oneself. A lot of what we learned about human nature in the past, 100 years, especially the past, 50 years, and you've had people on your show, tons of them, testifying to this, revised portrait of how human brains and minds work, suggests that this is a very challenging thing to confront. The other important part of the challenge, I think, is that, and it's got to be really frustrating for you guys to listen to this in the modern context when do your own research is a slogan that people raise all the time now. And I can take it upon oneself to be the arbiter of reliable knowledge in this domain. I'm not going to trust what people say to me, these so-called experts. I'm going to, adjudicate this for myself. There's a whole culture war around this as a goal. But everything we know about human nature suggests that our epistemically weakest form of human being is the solo human being, the human being operating independent of engagement with other people, critical others, much less other experts and so forth, or institutions of knowledge and learning. The solo human being is the most vulnerable to all these biases and all these different ways in which our brains deceive us.
Implicit in what you're saying, and I agree with those points that you're making as what are the benefits, I think it's implicit in what you're saying, but you didn't use the word curiosity. I call it genuine curiosity, which is almost an emotion. I don't know if it really qualifies as an emotion by psychologists, and we have talked about this a number of times on the show, but sometimes when I get into discussion with someone that I can really get into the discussion with, we may be attempting to argue our own points of view, but in the argument, I either have enough respect for the person or a strong enough relationship, then I may begin to actually think, and I hear myself and monitor myself, and I maybe get into this idea of I wonder really now, I have this opinion, but I wonder really if that's the whole truth, if there's some other aspects. And I then really get into an emotion that I really want to know. It's not that I'm trying to persuade anymore or press my point of view. It's I really want to know. So curiosity, I think, is a big part of that. But the big question and the hard question is, how do we persuade or encourage, incentivize other people to use more critical thinking?
I'm happy to do a little reset on the jag I was on. What I was trying to lead up to bears on this point is that what the 20th century has taught us about knowledge as a human endeavor is that it's a social achievement. It's not an individual achievement, primarily. That is, knowledge in science or any kind of human endeavor where you have to engage reality, where reality can bite back at you. Knowledge, education, or science, education, the legal system, government, policy, where you take actions and they have effects in the world that affects people. And those effects can be good or bad. There can be a measure of success or failure. Then all those institutions require a kind of reality-based methodology for staying plugged in to the facts on the ground. You wouldn't have space shuttles that can fly. You wouldn't have, smartphones that can work or any of this modern technology without that. But you have like reality-based institutions where there are standards of reasoning that are required in order to institution to function well. Journalism like this. Fact-checking, for example. And so all those institutions, insofar as you think they're important for social progress, for liberal democratic values, and they are science, journalism, education, government, the law. They're foundational to the institutions of our social democratic life. If those aren't allowed to operate according to standards of logical rigor, of empirical standards of grounded knowledge, then they fall apart. Then that's the difference between like an autocratic culture that sort of controls the science or controls the legal system or controls journalism or controls all that stuff. If those don't have an independent constitution that allows them to operate outside of all of that independently, you don't have liberal democracy at all anymore. Those are these pillars of modern liberal democratic society that only operate if you've got essentially critical thinking principles instantiated and practiced within the confines of those institutions. If you care about maintaining liberal democratic values and institutions that function well, you need to be able to protect and preserve those institutions from being co-opted, torn apart, asunder by powers that would take away their ability to do this kind of thinking and work. So that's, I think, a pretty strong argument for recruiting people into this service, learning these skills, because a lot of what we take for granted in our culture that we value relies on them, even if it's not always obvious. And you have to protect it because they're always there, especially now you see when people talk about the government takeover of certain institutions or challenging the autonomy of these institutions. That's a worrisome trend. So there's a social dimension to this. And then, as you mentioned, there's the individual dimension of, people's pursue their own rational self-interest that matters to them, their own, they want to be able to be effective communicators and engage in the world in an effective way. That's a value to them. They want to pursue, be a good citizen of a democratic culture. It means you have to you're ultimately responsible for the decisions of your representatives, and so the informed public is essential to the healthy functioning of those institutions. And then there's philosophical wisdom and the goals of like acquiring a deep understanding, knowledge of a certain domain or a subject matter that matters to you. All that stuff is enabled by learning critical thinking skills, critical thinking, writing, reasoning skills in collaboration with others. All of that stuff is enabled by it. So if you care about all that, then you should care about learning those skills.
Yeah, speaking of learning those skills, let's kind of take a step back and get into some more kind of basics. I think what you're describing really gets me thinking about the differences between practicing critical thinking, as you put it, in the dojo versus the street. You know, we have sort of the academia, and then we're talking about policy decisions and the integrity of institutions and things like that. I'd like to talk a little bit about what it means to engage in critical thinking. You've already kind of gone there with, you know, the application of law and science and policy. But most of all, you mentioned the word skills, because it is a skill. It's something that, much like in a dojo or on a street, that we are cultivating. It's easy to assume that, you know, everyone already knows this, but what are those fundamental skills that are required to learn and practice critical thinking so that we can preserve the integrity of our liberal democracy and our attachment with reality? I'll just put it that way.
That's a contested question, I think, in the critical thinking domain, because there's a sort of space in which the question is often framed so that critical thinking skills are often framed as the skills associated with individual learners. But and so they'll talk about, you know, your ability to process, to evaluate information that's coming into you, identify good arguments, distinguish good arguments from bad arguments, distinguish manipulative persuasion versus legitimately strong persuasion, do certain kinds of analysis, construct good arguments of your own. So there's the sort of self-defense side of things. And then there's the sort of positive, can you engage in the world in a way where you actually, you know, engage in reasonable argumentative discourse, you construct views of your own, and self-assess your own views. There's metacognitive parts of this where you have to be try to become aware of your own vulnerability. So can you practice a kind of mindfulness around epistemic humility, understand that you're likely going to be wrong, or that you need to sort of be aggressively stress testing your views. So these are, you know, a cluster of things, but they all operate around this vision of the subject of critical thinking is the individual person. And that kind of bias towards individuality, I think, is a problem here, because one of the things we've learned about cognition, about thinking, is that it really happens much outside the brain as inside. You know, there's this notion of the extended mind. I don't know if you had anybody on your show who's talked about the extended mind thesis.
Well, are you talking about the brain as a predictive machine? Tell us what you mean by extended mind and we'll see.
The idea that cognition isn't something that wholly happens inside the brain, that extends into the body, the environment, social relationships. We don't just think with our brains. But mental states of cognition, perceiving, acting, remembering, analyzing, these are things that we do, deliberation, that can extend outside the brain. So, for example, if I use a notebook to record my thoughts and write down the directions or a map, so I'm using the notebook as a kind of extended memory source there. And I can know, and I can use it. So I don't have to load up my own brain for this, because I can put it in the notebook or my smartphone and use that for, you know, these are extensions of memory and so forth. Computers are like that as well. The study of this has goes back, you know, 50, 60 years or longer. The idea is that it'd be very hard to navigate the world if we had to create an internal model of the whole world in order to predict, for example, whether, you know, how to walk across the room if our brains had to have a whole worked out internal model of the room inside the brain to tell the muscles and things where to go and to fire. That's cognitively exponentially expensive. Wouldn't it be easier if you were kind of plugged in directly to the physical environment of the room so that all you had to do was pick up information about from your perception of the room? Through your sensory, you know, the flow of imagery across your optic nerve, for example. So you become aware of shapes in the room and so on. And then the room itself can be, you don't need to have a model of the room in your head, because the room is already there. So all you have to do is sort of interact with the room, and yeah, extension and cognition can sort of loop out outside the brain, the body, into the environment and back. So other examples of this involve like embodied cognition, where we know that just the body first. When you take notes with your handwriting, that seems to be different. You process that information differently than if it's typed. That is, your recall and the type of knowledge you remember is different. So that affects learning and recall. So that's something about the process of encoding outside the brain, because it's done through like your hand, for example, or the combination of your hand versus typing. And we know that things like our physical environment affects cognition strongly, like the height of a ceiling. Like if you want to do a learning task, it can make a difference whether you're in a room with a high ceiling or a low ceiling. That outcome is different. If you have windows or not, if the ambient light and sound is a certain way, all of these have predictable experimental effects on your ability to learn and process certain kinds of thoughts. In fact, in a higher ceiling, you're more open to talking about high-level concepts, literally. Whereas in a low-level ceiling, like a cozy space, you're more disposed to talk about intimate details of things like relationships. So the idea that we are, as thinking beings, we move through the world, our bodily state affects our ability to think. If our posture is bad, our thinking can be degraded. If we're physical stress, emotional stress, fatigue, hunger, all that stuff impacts cognitive performance. Why is that, right? These are physical states of the body impact your ability to recall, to learn, to remember, to perceive. Even things like what I'm doing here, gesturing with hands. Turns out that if you try to solve a problem, you allow yourself to gesture with hands, you can do a better job of it than if your hands are tied. So there's this entire body of literature around embodied cognition, right? Education does this, has been studying this for years, where, you know, turns out that students will remember facts better in a class. Well, if they learn a certain set of facts in a classroom with a certain physical environment, you put them in a different environment, they have a hard time recalling them, but those facts. But if you put them back in the same environment in which they learned them, the recall is better. They've done this study where you put people underwater and they learn there, you know, 30 feet underwater in scuba equipment, and they have to memorize certain things, and they test them when they're in dry land versus back in the tank, and their recall is better if they're back in the environment in which they learned it. So what is going on here? So that we have is this tons of evidence, right, that thinking happens, is affected not just by the brain, but by the body, and also by the physical environment in which we're in. And not only that, our social relationships, we have our disposition to all sorts of psychological dispositions and life outcomes are affected by the friend network that we happen to live in. So, you know, people often say you're the average of the five people you hang out the most with. Well, there's some truth to this network effects, where simply being around people of certain types disposes us to think and behave in certain ways effortlessly, because we're around the people who think and behave that way as well. So how do you account for that ability, right? To, if it's just your brain, right? So you have this distributed cognition idea that knowledge and problem solving can be distributed across groups. Now we get into team-based learning, where no individual understands a problem, but the team does. The team is solving a problem, but each individual is simply contributing a part to it. Very, very human kind of cognition. So you see how we're going outward. Then there's thinking with experts, and there's thinking with peer networks, mentorship, books, the practice of reading a book, externalizing knowledge trapped in a book, and then being able to go back and forth and engage with the book. So the whole idea here is that we have this extended set of cognitive abilities that the brain is orchestrating all this stuff in terms of our experience of the world, but cognition itself is happening outside the brain. This is the extended mind thesis. And there's a whole bunch of critical thinking outcomes that follow from that, actually. And they're very mundane, like getting enough sleep, having a full belly, turns out to be a really important factor in your ability to learn.
There's been a long time fallacious understanding, I think primarily in Western thinking, that our intelligence is basically our brain. We live behind our eyes, and that is who we are, and that is how we achieve logic. But as you're saying, we're very much more than that. We have a nervous system that goes throughout our body. We produce neurotransmitters in our gut, you know, and that we're kind of taking a step out of that and looking more kind of who we are as whole beings. So I think that that makes a lot of sense. And I think we're still kind of combating this idea that somehow our brains are these like magic computer machines that, if are trained or properly, can come up with all the right answers and the logic and everything, when really it's much more complex than that. And we are also in the context of social animals. You know, so I think all of that makes a lot of sense. We've touched on it maybe in other shows, but I think it's worth emphasizing because it's been a long standing fallacious understanding of how the mind works. And I would say mostly in Western thought.
This conversation is interesting. You know, the embodied cognition of George Lakoff and others, we've talked a little bit about that. Kevin, as you were describing what you're describing, it sounds to me, and I'm just guessing on this, that these are some thoughts that have entered into your thinking since you've become involved in the business aspects. I'm just guessing that, talking about teams and the awareness of our teams in our lives and how they affect our thinking. So I'm guessing that. And the other thing I was thinking about as you were talking is it sounds like you're describing, you could put it in computer science terms of saying that some of these things prompt subroutines that are already existing from our experience that come into play that we may not even be aware of. Now, all of that put together brings me to a question that I was going to ask later, but I just have to ask it now because it's something I wonder so much about and agonize over, because what you're describing is things that sort of, like Julia just talked about, they're happening underneath the hood. We're not even aware of them. They may influence our intuitive thinking. When we talk about critical thinking, in the most part, we're talking about those skills that we can actually consciously decide this is what we want to do. We want to look for evidence. We want to put it into a format of drawing our conclusions with the principles of logic. That's more of a conscious. We're not, that doesn't happen under the hood. It doesn't happen subconsciously. We have to make some sort of conscious decision. And this leads us to the whole idea of, do we really have free will? Is there such a thing? Are we just fooling ourselves when we're talking about critical thinking? We're playing with the idea that we can actually do this. How does it really take place? Or are we really guided by all of the decisions being made under the hood and the committee of different neural pathways that are operative under the hood? They come to a committee decision as to what comes into our consciousness and the idea that we actually can consciously decide to use critical thinking is bogus. You know, it all happens under the hood, you know, and some people are more prone to it than others. And some people are more prone to using information as a political weapon than others, you know. So where does that leave us?
Well, this is, in fact, this is the framing for my whole sort of intellectual journey, frankly, is around, you know, introduced to the sort of classical model of critical thinking, goals, values, and skills. And then you spend some time learning about how human brains and minds actually work. So that gets us into the cognitive bias literature. And you learn that human beings are systematically prone to irrationality. But that's built into us as an evolutionary trade-off, because in order to think fast and to take decisive actions fast, these actions have to be driven by rules of thumb as opposed to long, drawn-out, effortful, conscious deliberation. You got to be able to think fast, so you have a heuristic bam, it's fast processing, unconscious processing. That's valuable when it saves your skin, right? It makes us prone to certain kinds of errors, but it's a trade-off. And then, you know, looking at the sort of broader category of dual process theories of cognition, which is what we're talking about with unconscious versus conscious processing, we learn that most of our thinking, most of the information processing that determines our conscious beliefs and our observed behaviors arises subconsciously. It's the tip of the iceberg versus all the stuff below the waterline. And that gives rise to people like Jonathan Haidt. Have you had him on the show?
No. We've mentioned his work, but haven't had him.
A big whale to capture him at some point. But, you know, in his book, The Righteous Mind, he introduced this notion of a theory called social intuitionism. And it's really about, you know, different types of what we learn about how human beings actually reason, process. And in that book, he's worried, he's interested in the differences between how liberals versus conservatives versus libertarians think and reason about the world. He introduces this idea that most of our conscious human reasoning is really a post hoc rationalization for judgments that are rooted in our guts and our feelings. So that's the intuitionist thesis. So like we have a gut intuition, and it's rooted viscerally or emotionally or affectively in our bodies and our judgment or subconsciously. And then our behavior, we're not aware of that though. We believe that we're sort of consciously rationalizing our judgments by offering reasons, but the reasons are really post hoc. We're sort of confabulating them, as opposed to the reasons were not in fact the causes of the judgment or the causes of the behavior. They're something that we create after the fact in order to give an accounting of our behavior to other human beings or to ourselves maybe. Now, if that's right, and there's a number of cognitive biases that seem to operate according to that description, then we clearly have some limits on the self-ownership of our beliefs. We just don't have as much control over the formation of our beliefs as we think we do. Now, that I think is something that we can just grant. So I think there's no way of turning back that part. There's no reframing of this or we get to recover the full control of our belief formation because that ship has sailed. What doesn't follow, though, is that we abandon a sense of responsibility for our own beliefs because of this. So at what stage, there is the metacognitive point that we, now that we're aware of this, most of my behavior really is generated subconsciously. What does that mean for me? If I care about that fact, then it means that I'm going to be motivated to be more humble about the beliefs I have, to look for opportunities to test them against different kinds of facts, different kinds of agreement. It requires an attitude of skeptical vigilance about your own thinking. But it doesn't mean that your beliefs can't be subject to rational verification or justification, but it's not something you can do by yourself. That says the solo person is not equipped to do that work. You have to engage with the world. You engage with evidence that and other people and other artifacts and tools. These are the cognitive infrastructure of thinking. It extends beyond ourselves. If you take seriously the point we just made earlier, that knowledge is a kind of social achievement. It's not an individual achievement, usually. Then you have to engage the person socially so they have access to the various cognitive resources that we can avail ourselves of to stress test, to confirm, to get agreement around, so that these individual biases are not driving the whole ship. But as soon as you have people who become distrustful of social institutions of knowledge or expertise, or distrustful of other groups and their point of view, so that you are sort of creating a smaller and smaller circle of influence around your own beliefs, then the quality of your beliefs just declines precipitously. It's like you're just more and more likely to be involved in a kind of epistemic bubble, like a fragmented, self-contained thing that seems persuasive from the inside, but in fact is disconnected from reality outside of it. And this is unfortunately the social condition that we're seeing in. This is the thing that caused me as much distress as it did when I was, you know, in 2018, and I stopped posting on social media. I stopped creating content for the Critical Thinking Academy, the Argument Ninja, partly because my other work was keeping me very busy, but also it felt like, no, we're just sort of seeing this path towards greater, greater epistemological fragmentation. And the threat of that, and the threat to these institutions of knowledge that really require a kind of shared reality among people, sort of agreement among groups for them to work, was very distressing to me, actually. And I saw that trend that increasingly you were talking about a post-truth society. Experts are having conferences around, we live in a post-truth society now because of this. And they're evoking kind of postmodern language, like we have we're moved beyond the era where intersubjective agreement on important issues is going to ever be possible again. What we have is simply competing ideologically driven bubbles with not enough overlap to able to sustain the mechanisms of knowledge production that are healthy for us. That was pretty distressing to me because I think there's some truth to this. And actually, I should ask you guys, you're in the business of observing this and talking to people about these trends. Do you think that that's a fair description?
I do, and sometimes I get depressed by it myself and discouraged. But the thing that is helping me get a little encouragement and hope in what you say is you're putting emphasis on collaboration with other human beings in order to help us all arrive at things that are more likely to be true, liable to be realistic. And of course, that's the essence of the scientific approach, because I mean, the emphasis there is to get your ideas, your research, publish that to your peers and anyone else that wants to look at it, and then take the critique and continue the dialogue. And so that's the essence. That's a very key point in scientific thinking. So that gives me a little hope. But I do want to point this out. Our first episode with you, Kevin, I went back and looked, and we had 15 questions. And in the first episode with you, we got to question number 3. Yeah. Now, I mean this as a compliment more than anything, and that means that we're getting into some real discussion. We're getting away from our agenda of the plan for all of the stuff that we'd like to cover, and that's happening again here. So I'm going to move us on a little bit here with a question that I do want to get into and make sure that we cover, because we're so much in this show about giving resources to our listeners. So we like to send them to a place where they can go get more information. We're here to pique their interest and hope they'll go further. So over the years, we've mentioned a lot of resources for learning critical thinking skills. And what you've developed, as Kevin, has always been at the top of my list. So give us a rundown. If people are interested now in preserving our democracy and learning how to do civil dialogue and good argumentation with other people to hopefully improve their ability to understand reality, then where would they go? What's available in your current catalog? So give listeners a little bit of a roadmap and maybe think about two tracks there. Tracks for people who are just tuning in and go, critical thinking, this sounds kind of interesting. I think I'd like to learn more about it. So for the beginner, and also a track for people who maybe have some critical thinking skills and just want to supplement those skills.
I would say for people who've got some prior exposure to like college courses and philosophy course they took or something. So they did a course on a little bit of logic and argument analysis. So they're used to, I think it's great to do refreshers around that stuff because there is a whole discipline and training, even if it doesn't seem to show up as much in the street, as it were. The thinking skills you learn from learning principles of good versus bad argumentation are systemic to your thinking. College instructors complain that their students coming to them from high school, they always complain about the ability to read and process complex texts. Now, though, in the post-COVID response to this is that there's a crisis. We've got the Chronicle of Higher Education, who's published two things recently about receiving students who've never read a book through their in their entire high school career, who are unable to parse college-level texts of any kind, and who have no discipline built in to try to tackle them. That is, they simply don't do it. So more and more university and college professors are pressured not to assign readings like that anymore, to spend more time doing the scaffolded interpretive work in class rather than assigned readings, because they will reliably come back with a third or half to more, two-thirds of a class who will not have done the work. And so this is like a warning bell. And one of the things that exposure to argument analysis does, it gives you the tools to apply that to parsing the argumentative context out of texts. Getting that exposed to that in high school is a fundamental skill, which is not taught. So my recommendations for young people is that they do get some training in this. They won't get it in high school normally, but there are lots of good textbooks. And I've got a bunch of courses on my site, on argumentninja.com or on Critical Thinker Academy, that go through basic principles of argument analysis. I think it's fundamental. And the other side of that is getting informed about principles of how the brain works. It's like the owner's manual for your own body. You wouldn't want to drive a car if you had no idea of how cars function, operated. And here we are driving our bodies around the world with really poor understanding of how they operate. So getting some owner's manual understanding of how human beings work is essential. I've got a couple of courses on that on especially the focus on cognitive biases and heuristics. Again, I would say that material was fresh 10 years ago. It's still fresh if you've never been exposed to it, right? And most people haven't. So these are eternally fresh if you've never been exposed to it. But if I were to do new courses now, I would add courses on the extended mind and cognition. I would add courses on predictive processing and the predictive brain and the implications of that model as well. I think it's fundamental. I think the insight, especially the predictive processing model of the brain, gives us to the nature of why our biases occur. So much of the phenomenology of how brains work, minds work, and processing information is now, you know, within our grasp to explain it in virtue of these models. It's very powerful. That said, if you wanted to read some books on that stuff, you had Anil Seth on your podcast a while ago, his book, Being You, A New Science. So among this sort of class of really important perspectives on the brain and the mind, I would say his is there, because he does predictive processing and its applications to experience of the self. That's his primarily his focus. But predictive processing and its experience to things like a happiness. That's Daniel Gilbert, Stumbling Upon Happiness. One of the recurring themes in this material is, if you think of your brain as a kind of prediction engine, and you accept the thesis or the claim, which is central to this view, is that our experience of the world is actually an experience of our brain's predictions about what the world is like. If I expect to hear a certain sound or a word in an audio stream, I'll hear that sound or word, because if my prediction is dominating my experience, then it'll synthesize, it'll create that event for us. Or you'll fill in colors and things, or when you're reading, you jump around on a page, you're only sampling bits of the text, and your brain's filling in the rest of the letters because out of context, it's predicting the next thing. There's all kinds of examples of this. Here's a cool one, by the way, hunger. Your levels are getting down, so it responds in a way that wants to maintain this sort of balance of operating, you know, physically. So it signals a hunger or a thirst signal to you. And that causes you to go out and take action to do something that brings it back into its right level. When you take a swoop of that cold water or something, it feels immediately satisfying. The thirsty signal goes away almost right away. And if you take those first bites of food, the hunger signal goes away almost right away before the nutrients have gotten a chance to be introduced to your body and be absorbed and do the work. That is, your brain has synthesized the experience of, I feel satisfied now. I'm no longer thirsty. before the liquid has ever had the chance to do the physical thing of topping up your fluids. Because your brain has figured out, oh, you're out of the danger zone now. You've actually had a drink. So I'm going to make you feel like you've, thank goodness, right away. That's a synthesized experience. And that experience is the way the brain works all the time, according to this view. So there's tons of research. Read anything by Paul Slovak on risk. Read Lisa Feldman Barrett on emotions. Read anything on processing fluency to get exposed to the reality of our perception, the truthiness of things, why certain kinds of arguments and statements strike us as more likely true than false. It's connected to processing fluency. And the thing that I have not seen talked about much in the critical thing, in fact, I think I'll have to write a paper on this, is that we have these epistemic emotions like confidence, certainty, conviction, knowing. There's a feeling associated with all that stuff, right? Like, I know this, right? I get it. I call them epistemic emotions because they're used to signal a kind of understanding, kind of knowledge state. It turns out that all of those can be synthesized as well. The feeling of certainty and uncertainty, the feeling of knowing, degrees of confidence, judgments of the strength of an argument. That's a good argument. That's a bad argument. That's a promising argument. Truthfulness, factfulness, riskiness, common sense. So these are epistemic feelings. You have that feeling when you embrace it. All of those, normally, when we're operating well, we want to say, when we have that judgment, if I'm a critical thinker and I'm attuned properly, calibrated properly, then my sense of certainty should be calibrated to the evidence around the facts of the matter, right? So they adjust like this. But it turns out that all of those emotions can be manifested by your brain independent of the evidence.
So many thoughts, so little time, and we are out of time. So Kevin de la Plante, want to thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your experiences in the domain of critical thinking and philosophy and psychology. On our Facebook page, we're going to link to your personal website at Kevin de la Plante. That's KevinDelaPlante.com, which opens the door to the Argument Ninja Dojo membership program that has over 25 hours of video tutorial content available for members. And a hearty thank you to our listeners. Thanks for your support. And as always, Julia, thank you. And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.